Skull Rock Podcast, talking all things Disney with your hosts, Aljon Goh and Dave Bossert.
Welcome to Skull Rock Podcast. If this is your first time hearing the show, welcome. And if you're a longtime listener, welcome too. Because every week, we talk all things Disney and pop culture with never-before-heard stories, behind-the-scenes moments from some of your favorite Disney films, theme park attractions, performances, books, music, and so much more. I'm one of your co-hosts, Aljon Goh, musician, podcaster, longtime Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars fan. And you can email me, Aljon, A-L-J-O-N, at skullrockpodcast.com.
And I'm Dave Bossert. I'm an artist, filmmaker, and author, and welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, as well as like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And you can also email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. Aljon, yes, how are you? I think this is the last week of April.
I can't believe
Can you believe it already?
I can't. Mean,
spring is in the air, and you certainly know that because of your allergies.
Yeah. So, okay. So before we started hitting record on this program, I told Dave, if I look like a Sharpay at the end of this episode, you'll know why. We live in the, the Tennessee Valley and in Nashville. All the pollen collects, you know, there's always a layer of pollen on my car every morning. And I think a layer of it falls on my face every day. And my eyes are like swollen and teary. My wife's like, stop rubbing your eyes. And I can't help myself. So now it sounds like I've got the sniffles, but I take my allergy medicine religiously every day, regardless of season. I take it every day because my allergies are so bad. And even in this new house with hardwood floors, it has helped tremendously, but still. My eyes.
I feel for you. My dad had terrible allergies for years. He was allergic to everything. Mm. So I grew up with that. And fortunately, I did not inherit that from him.
Yeah. Well, good for you, Dave. Good for you. I'm glad you have a clean bill of health there. I have to say, though, before we continue, because I know we have a lot of stuff. We've got guests. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. The show is doing great. We've got tremendous listenership, ever since the Bob Gurr episode, it seems like everything has been just, flying off the chain here. The Dave Pricksma show, Chuck Williams, Ethan Reed, Dean Yeagle, like all these shows, of course, Kirk Wise last week. All those shows are doing really well. And thank you so much for everyone's support and subscribing to the show. And no matter what platform you're listening to, whether you're listening to us on our new friends at Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com on the All Talk side, or you're listening to us on iHeartRadio, or of course Apple and all the different podcasts, Spotify, Anchor. Thank you so much.
I got to tell you, thank you to everyone who's tuning in, and we're having a ball here. And I got to tell you, I've been getting a lot of great feedback from folks that I've been reaching out to and booking as guests for upcoming shows. They've actually been listening to the podcast and saying that there's a great vibe to the show. And I think, part of that is just you and I, Aljon, because, yeah. Like I said, from the beginning, you and I kind of clicked.
Absolutely. It's just fun. I mean, that's just two people just sitting here shooting the breeze, talking about the stuff they love, which is film and animation and music and illustration, comics, art. And that's all the geekery that you want. And we're just so happy to share that with you every single week. And if the rest of the community loves it, obviously we're here for you. And I'm glad everyone's listening. And thank you so much to all of the podcast community as well. I mean, we were on Disney Parks podcast not too long ago, and we just got an invitation to get on the Diz His, which is a Disney history podcast, Dave, that we're going to hopefully get on real soon to promote the show. But, awesome. We've got a lot more people that are are wanting to promote what we do. And so thank you so much to the Disney podcast community for embracing us. So thank you.
Yeah, it's really been a lot of fun. And again, a very wonderful community of podcasters out there, everybody supporting one another. And that's what I love about it. You know, it's not a competition. It's everybody's carving out their niche. And there's a lot of wonderful shows going on out there.
Absolutely. Cannot wait. But I know that we have a guest, Dave. You want to give a little teaser before we launch into the news?
We do. We in the green room is an old friend of mine, Marshall Toomey. He was a cleanup lead at Disney. He worked with Ralph Bakshi. He worked with Don Bluth. He worked at Filmation, did some incredible work for many, many years at Walt Disney Animation Studios. So I'm really looking forward to bringing him on shortly. But he's relaxing and munching down in the green room here at Skull Rock Podcast.
Yeah, you see, our listeners provide donuts for the green room, so this is a good thing that he's got something to kind of chew on while we go over the latest and greatest, which is the news.
Skull Rock Podcast, ripped from the headlines. It's Skull Rock Podcast Headline News.
And I just love that intro. So professional. From Wendy Schneider from Chicago. Chicago Raider. I love Wendy.
It's all a facade, isn't it?
It's all a facade. You know, it's, you know, Wendy Schneider's the best. And I know that, by the way, I have to give a shout out to Wendy Schneider because she is, their talk show in Chicago is coming to a close. And she's still going to stay on there in Chicago Radio, you know, in the news talk format. But she is the best. So I hope that she brings back Snyder Marks Radio. But I just have to give a shout out to Wendy because she's the best. I love her.
She's terrific, and she did a great job doing all these bumpers for us.
Her and her husband are the best. I love them to death. But anyway, HBO Max reaches 44.2 million subs. That's huge.
I think they seem to be very happy with that.
Wouldn't you? I would be. That's amazing. you know, look, they have premier content, and I'm trying to. I'm trying my very hardest to get Kristen for us to add this subscription service because they came out with Mortal Kombat this week. A couple weeks ago, they had Godzilla versus Kong, which is great. But I know that those blockbuster films, which are also really, you know, that are also in theaters, too. I guess they're not in theaters, right? They're streaming
well,
first.
Well, no, that I mean, Godzilla versus Kong was released
day and date
on HBO Max and in the theaters worldwide,
right.
and it's blown the doors off of the theater box office for, you know, really just doing it's like over $400 million globally, and that speaks volumes, Aljon, to the fact that people want to go out and go to the movie theaters.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. I got my wires crossed for whatever reason, but yes, they are domestic box office. You get the streaming service, so people have a choice in how they watch. And I have to say, Dave, for the very first time, and you're going to love this, we took Boo and Jack to the mall yesterday.
Mm. Wow.
It was packed. And guess what? Mm. The theater was packed.
Hey, you know, listen, I think that the movie theaters are going to come back with a vengeance this summer. And it kind of leads into our next story here, which is a traffic jam on the box office superhighway. And that is because there are so many great movies that were delayed because of the pandemic that are all going to come out. As one industry executive said, there's not going to be a lot of oxygen. You know, there's going to be one weekend after another. There's going to be a hit movie going into the theaters.
Yeah. You know, it's going to affect box office, of course. But I think, too, people are going to find their way to watch the films, whether they pay for it on a streaming service or advanced, whatever they call it. You know, viewing
the premium
access, right? Premium access
streaming.
That's right. So a lot of those films, you have Sony Marvel's effort, Venom 2, Let There Be Carnage, which is going to be great. You've got the Soprano Origins pick, The Many Saints of Newark, which I'm sure you're going to be down with, you know, being a huge fan of The Sopranos. You also have, what was it, Dune, that's supposed to release as well. And I'm looking forward to that.
Sure.
So
no, there's some great movies that are going to be coming out all through the summer. And I do think that they're going to be, you know, people are going to be pleasantly surprised at how quickly the movie theater business comes back to life.
So that's my prediction. So as these releases happen week after week, how do you think that, I mean, do you think people are just going to continue to just go, obviously you think that people are going to continue just to go to the theater, but how does that affect the industry when you have so many releases coming out in such a short time?
Well, it remains to be seen, but I have to tell you, you know, prior to the pandemic, I've talked about it many times on our show here that I typically go to the movie theater once a week. And I try to see a lot of different films. I mean, it's not unheard of for me to go to a movie theater twice in a week to see something that's just been released. And so I think that you're going to see a lot of these big films. People are going to want to see them on a big screen for no other reason than just to get out of the house, you know, and get back into some sort of normalcy of dinner and a movie, you know, date night, that kind of thing, you know.
Well, that's what we experienced, Dave, yesterday for probably the first time. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago how I met up with my family for the first time, you know, and you had met up with your mom for an overdue birthday celebration, 4 months overdue, but, you know, recently and traveling. And I just wanted to get out of the house. I wanted to get out of the house. I wanted to bring the kids. We went out. We ate at a German beer garden. You know, we had pretzels. We had, you know, schnitzel. We had like the whole nine. And the kids were happy. I was happy. We were out of the house. I was able to eat, you know, and go walk around and see people.
And I'm imagining you and Kristen had a pint or two. Did the kids have half pints?
No, they had their milk and sippy cups. That's what they had, Dave. But yes, we did have mommy and daddy juice ready.
There you go. I just think that the movie theater chains out there need to step up and start to make the movie going experience that much better. Make it a destination for people. They will come. If they just go back to the same old thing of having, you know, some slack jawed kids behind the concession counter moving in slow motion and, you know, 100 people online waiting to get something, you know, eventually people are just gonna say, this isn't worth it. I mean, I see it at my multiplex, and people are bringing in their own, you know, snacks and whatnot and bags and bypassing the counter. I think that the movie theaters have to rethink the experience itself. Mm-hmm. You know, what can they do that makes it even more attractive for people to say, hey, let's go to the movies instead of staying home?
Loyalty cards. They need more loyalty cards. And I think the subscription service model can work out for a theater. If you, you know, they toyed a little bit with this pre-pandemic, you know, with these type of, you know, quarterly, yearly plans where you can go unlimited amount of times to the theater. And I think that may be the key. You know, you give people what they perceive as huge value. I think families have been scientifically proven, okay, by that they go to the theater at least maybe twice a year. And if you make it more feasible for them to get value out of it, they'll take their families to the theater more often and buy the snacks and buy the drinks and stuff like that to make it more appealing to families who want to go to the theater.
Agreed, but also I think reserve seating. Some theaters are doing it, but not all of them. It needs to be commonplace.
I agree.
You know, any theater you go to, you got to be able to say, I'll take those two seats. And then you don't have to worry about getting there an hour beforehand and having to wait on a line and all of that baloney.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they really need to step it up.
Yeah, I prefer it. And if you have the ushers do their jobs and make sure that they seat you where they need to be seated, you know, that's great, because there's nothing worse than, because that's how I see all the blockbusters. I go to Fandango, I click the link, and I get my preferred seats. And then I see someone sitting in my seat, and that's no bueno, Dave.
No, I agree with you on that.
No bueno.
Hey, and speaking of all these movies coming out, I had the opportunity to get a sneak peek at The Mitchells versus the Machines.
This is why I envy you. This is why I envy you, because this is the cool advice.
This is a new animated film from the folks over at Sony Animation, awesome. Sony Pictures Animation, also known as SPA.
I love the SPA.
But they actually completed this movie during the pandemic. And I got to tell you, this is from the filmmakers who did Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and the Lego Movie.
It's wonderful.
And I watched this film and I was laughing out loud. I thought it was hilarious. It was really well done. The voice casting is terrific. You've got great design, great production design on it. It was really great team of people that put this movie together. It's going to premiere, I believe, on April 30th on Netflix.
It looks really, really good. And I have to say, The cast of voices, okay, typically I'm all about the regular voice actors doing it, but when you get a cast as funny as this cast, you have Charlene Yee, and she is just a spitfire. She is just great, and I love her work anyway. She was awesome and Knocked Up and so many other things that she's been in, Good Girls. She's just funny, for one. Then you have Maya Rudolph.
She's fabulous. McBride, absolutely fabulous as the mom of the Mitchells.
Yep.
Mom Mitchell.
Absolutely.
I mean, she's terrific. You know, again, Aljon, this is a visual feast. It's a lot of fun. I love the visual style that these filmmakers employed. And again, it's like what they did with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, it's distinct.
Just visually a stunning film.
Yeah.
This is different, but they're using, I think, some wonderful techniques. You know, it's a CG movie, but there's some 2D animation elements that are consistent throughout. And it's really just a great picture. And I would encourage people to see this when it premieres on Netflix.
Yeah, the boilerplate reads like this. A quirky, dysfunctional family road trip is upended when they find themselves in the middle of the robot apocalypse and suddenly become humanity's unluckiest last hope. And it looks very claymation to me, which I really dig. So I'm all about it. And of course, I'm a big fan of Conan O'Brien. So
Conan does one of the voices. Fred Armitage does a voice. I mean, it's just really a fun movie. And if you want to have a 2-hour laugh fest, you got to see this picture.
Speaking of laugh fest, have you heard this?
I need to watch this movie.
You ever seen Spider-Man Homecoming?
This is okay. So let me give you some context. This is Tom Holland several years ago talking to Anthony Mackie in an interview at Ace Comic-Con, being interviewed by Kevin Smith. So let's back this up and play this clip again.
I need to watch this movie.
You ever seen Spider-Man Homecoming?
I haven't seen the Falcon. Oh, no, there isn't one. Sorry.
So Tom Holland busting the chops of Anthony Mackie because he hasn't seen Spider-Man Homecoming. Anthony Mackie taking it on the chin like a champ. Hey, hold on. Well played. Well played, Tom Holland. So I play that because it's resurfaced again because Falcon and Winter Soldier are going into the big screen. Captain America sequel in development with Falcon and Winter Soldier head writer Malcolm Spellman I'm not going to spoil this, Dave, because I don't know if you saw the finale of the series that launched on Friday. I don't know if you caught up.
No, I'm not caught up. I've only watched a couple of episodes. I'm going to have to try and binge watch the rest of it at some point.
Well, you must. That's your homework, because I have to say, I was tickled pink. I was tickled pink in so many ways. So satisfying. almost talked like Yoda there for a minute. So satisfying the finale was, you know, but it really was. It really was satisfying. First of all, it wasn't heavy-handed in social commentary, which is always great because it leads the people to explore the different themes that they have throughout the entire series. The way, you know, Black Americans are treated, the way we treat our war heroes, the way the government treats individuals and groups, and how displaced individuals. Look, I'm not a woke person, but I can tell you that it works on so many different levels, and that's the beauty of storytelling, that there's so many layers to this that you can apply no matter what side of the political spectrum you're in, because it's all about good story and about good versus evil. There are truths among the universe. What is good is always going to be good. And that's my thought.
And you know what? We're all individuals. We that's all right. have opinions. We can all sit back and listen to one another.
Well, I will say, Anthony Mackie is my Captain America. I've always been, it's not about Black Captain America, it's about Captain America. And I can tell you that Anthony Mackie is a wonderful actor. My wife and I just love Anthony Mackie. We love Winter Soldier as well. We love Bucky Barnes. We love, you know, what's going on with Chris Evans and old Steve Rogers, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I say Bucky Barnes, Sebastian Stan, pardon me. It's great. I will say this, and I'm very, very happy that they decided to have Falcon, and we knew it was leading up to this, to once again embrace the mantle of Captain America. And it's not Black Captain America, it's just Captain America. And
awesome.
I love it. And the movie is in the works, and I cannot wait to see how all of this unfolds in the future with, once again, Malcolm Spellman, you know, at the helm of this. So he's writing. And kudos to Marvel for making that announcement right there on the heels of the final episode of Falcon and Winter Soldier, or shall I say Captain America and Winter Soldier.
Cool. And speaking of Marvel, this was an interesting little tidbit from Variety.
Yeah.
Fans put up a billboard asking Marvel to bring Tony Stark back to life.
talk about fan service. Talk about fans banding together to inspire something to happen. I would love that. But, you know, I think there is future hope for that. You know, now that time travel is a thing in Marvel movies, you'll never say never. And I think they would be leaving a tremendous amount of money on the table if they don't bring back Robert Downey Jr. in some way, shape, form, or fashion down the road for Marvel movies.
Well, all I can say is don't be surprised. Don't be surprised if they do something like that.
Do you have any insider?
I don't know anything. I haven't heard anything, but you know, stranger things have happened, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, anyway, I'm all about it. And for more details on this, of course, you know, we keep our fingers on the pulse of what's going on in Hollywood when it comes to TV and movies and streaming services. And if there's in particular topic you want us to delve into for this news segment, feel free to email us and we will tackle it in the next show. Pete, please email us.
Okay. I think it's time to go to our guest.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Skull Rock Podcast. Interview time.
Well, Al John, as promised, we've got a wonderful guest this week. He's an old friend of mine from Walt Disney Animation Studios, Marshall Toomey. He's worked with Ralph Bakshi, Don Bluth. He's worked at Filmation, and he had an amazing run with with so many great artists at Walt Disney Animation Studios for many years, working on films like Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King. He's an animator, a cleanup key, a cleanup supervisor, a fine artist, a great illustrator. He's, I mean, just an all-around great guy. And I want to welcome you, Marshall, to the Skull Rock Podcast. It's so great to have
Thanks
you on.
So much. It's great to be here. Wow, what an introduction. I love that. That was great. I never hear all that stuff together like that. So.
Well, you know, and as I say to all of our guests that we have on the show, we can't possibly cover your entire career in an hour. But but what we're going to do is we're going to sort of go back. And what I like to ask our guests is, how the heck did you get into the animation business? When did it start for you? Was it high school? Were you drawing cartoons to try and get the girls?
I did that forever and ever. I was drawing cartoons at home in my lap. And I got to go way back. Daddy, we used to go to camp. I suppose you went to Boy Scout camp and all that stuff, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I found that I hated it. The bugs, the boys, the swimming. It was just, I don't like it. So one year I told Daddy, I said, I don't want to do this anymore, Daddy. Every summer you send me out of here. I don't. He says, okay, what do you want to do? I said, I don't know, something else. It was his idea. I said, well, you love to draw. He started sending me to all these art schools. There were kid classes at the Kansas City Art Institute. Mm-hmm. That changed my life. That was forever.
Which is wonderful. I mean, that's a world-class operation, the Kansas City Art Institute.
Absolutely. I mean, and there I was in the middle of it with my little pad walking around. But I learned so much, and Daddy kind of got me on that right road of headed towards it just to keep me happy. It wasn't though he was trying to, you got to go to camp. No, let's do this for him. I fell in love with it. I had always been in love with drawing since I was about three. Went to college. I played football in high school and basketball and track, and I got to be an athletic star, but I was always drawing.
I am not surprised by that. I have to tell, I want our listeners to know, how tall are you? You're at least
6'4".
You're six foot four. Oh. And so when you stand next to Marshall Toomey, you kind of look over and go, yeah, this guy probably played football. You know what I mean?
Or it could have been a professional wrestler. I mean, you tell me.
So, you know, there was that. So when I went to college on a football scholarship, I decided to be an art major because that's what I knew how to do. The football team hated that. The coach hated that. Everybody hated that. Okay. Anyway, college went on. I got out of school because I lost my knee hurt, lost my scholarship. Daddy says, I don't have no money. I had to leave school. So I started.
Where'd you go to school?
Baker University in Kansas, Baldwin City, Kansas.
Wow.
1971 to 1973. Well, I just gave my years away. Okay.
Wow.
Anyway, I finally got a job after loading trucks and stuff. I finally got an art job at a little animation studio. At this little animation studio, they taught me to do the animation, the backgrounds, the layouts, the special effects, these little mom and pop, and paint it and then shoot it. We used to do stuff for Caterpillar. So we would animate those tractor engines all over the place all the time, which you might have loved. I didn't like it at all. But we kept doing that. But I learned a lot. I learned so much. And then the job was over. You know, it was like, okay, we're done. It was about 6 months, but I had it. The bug, I was done. I said, I got it. So my buddies and I sit around in Kansas City drinking and fussing at the white man for holding us down, as we always did. Sorry, I understand. That's what we were doing.
It's hilarious.
We should have got up and gone out and looked for a job, but that wasn't the thing. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to complain. But one day I just said, you know what, man? I can't do this anymore. We got to do something. I know how to do this job. I really didn't, but I thought I did. So we've convinced ourselves, there's about four or five of us. I was the only one that wanted to be an animator. Everybody else wanted to be a producer, director, blah, blah, blah. We decided to buy one-way tickets to LA.
Wow.
19, and I, man, whew, that was scary. We bought the one-way tickets in 1977, got here. Within a week, I found Ralph Bakshi's address. That was the only place. I didn't want to go to Disney. I was intimidated because if they said no, my heart would have been broken and I'd be crushed. So I wouldn't go to Disney. So I went to Ralph Bakshi's. And Ralph was great. We talked for a long time. And then we had this little argument. Well, you can't animate. I said, but he says, but you can draw like crazy. I said, I can animate. He says, no, you can't. I said, yes, I can. No, you can't animate. Yeah, I can't. He finally got tired. I said, you know what? I'm tired. I'm going to hire you just because I don't feel like arguing with you anymore. That's how I got my first job.
What was Ralph like? Well, you know, I always ask people this because I never worked for him. I've only heard stories from various folks and some of them are crazy stories, but what was your experience with Ralph?
He was real quirky. He had a lot of things going on in his mind at all times. And when you walk into his office, that's the way his office is. He had all these things going on his mind at all times. He was funny. He was very relaxed. I think he was a little bit too relaxed for animation. I think, you know, he was just very laid back about the whole thing. But man, we were doing great stuff. And he had that Disney theory back then of hiring the best folks he could hire, you know, and then just let them run. And that's right. What he was doing. So it was great. It was a great experience. That job didn't last long. But
you worked on Heavy Metal, right?
I worked on Heavy Metal.
We got to talk about that. It's one of my favorite movies.
Oh man, thank you. I loved it.
The
Tarnas sequence.
That's right, and it's amazing because first of all, I'm a big like Dungeons and Dragons fan anyway. But the fantasy element of that is just amazing. And once again, it's one of my favorite animated films. And when I found out you were coming on the show, I'm like, we got to talk about Heavy Metal because it seems to me just like such a, it's underappreciated by a lot of people, but man, the fans for the decades that love this movie. And it just seems to me like just so many creative people expressing themselves in those different segments, like yourself. I mean, how did you get involved into getting into this Heavy Metal film, and how much of yourself is actually in that segment? Were you able to express?
I was called by, this was my first time meeting her at this point now in life. She's one of my favorite cleanup artists that I've ever worked with. I think she's one of the best in the world. Renee Holt called me and said, I heard you might be available to help out on this movie. So I grabbed my little two-year-old and ran to her studio. I had been working at Filmation, so I had gotten used to the system, used to working and things like that. So when I went to see her, she only had time to say, here are the scenes I have to give you. She was rushing all over the place, but her work was breathtaking. It was fabulous. And here, I've keyed a few things. Which means she did the first and second and last and third drawings. Those are what keys are. She keyed the drawings, gave me about three scenes, and then sent me back home. Because my little boy was running all over the place, making all kind of noise, and he was very distracting. I love him. I tell him this story all the time now that he's old. But I went back, and it was the first time I had worked at my house in my little animation table with something, and it was personal because it was different. It wasn't He-Man. It was this thing, and Tarna didn't have clothes on, and most of the stuff I was drawing, it's like, wow, we're doing this the way it should be, and it was great. I don't think we could have done that without understanding construction and body. You know, the whole, so
the basics, artistic, the basics,
yeah, the real basics, which a lot of folks don't get now, those basics really help coming up. Mm-hmm.
Gravity.
Now, you worked on that, on Heavy Metal, and then from there you went to Filmation, or did you go to
I was
Don
already
Bluth?
At Filmation, and I stepped away.
Oh, okay,
to do Heavy Metal, and then I went back to Filmation. I was at Filmation for about 8 years. So we got a lot. I did every He-Man episode there was to do, but we didn't get credits because I was an assistant animator at the time. So I'm sitting next to Bruce Smith, who was just animating away, getting all kinds of stuff, but I was cleaning up. And because we were assistant animators, we didn't get to get those credits. So
And you also did She-Ra as well, yes. Right? Because so
yes. I didn't do every episode of that. Right.
But, well, fun fact, Dave, Kristen and I are huge Masters of the Universe fans, and Kristen is 100% all about She-Ra.
There you go.
My wife is all about it. So I was like, yep, Filmation, yep. I once again, just another great part of our childhood growing up is those Filmation, animation shows, for sure.
They were great. I got the privilege of working on the last season of Fat Albert, which was, for me, it was great because the idea of working on it was, was a wonderful thing. Working on Fat Albert, Lone Ranger, Brave Star, I can't name everything. We went to a reunion dinner last year. We were trying to figure out the names of everything. We couldn't figure out all the names.
No, they put out so many shows.
It was
really something else. I mean, between them and Hanna-Barbera, that was Saturday morning.
Pretty much.
It was Saturday morning, period. It was really cornered.
Now, did you step away from Filmation to go work on The Secret of NIMH?
I was kind of done with Filmation. I had been doing live action music videos too, because in the 80s, remember, music videos were just coming out. So I was actually art directing music videos and working at Filmation, but then Secret of NIMH came up. I dropped everything and got on that movie, met Vera Lamfer, who is probably the greatest cleanup artist that ever lived. But she taught me the world. She taught me that world that leads to Disney. That's the best way to say that. She taught me the way to get, the type of artwork you need to be working towards, the way you need to draw, the way you need all of that towards there.
And they were doing it on The Secret of NIMH, because they had all left Disney to do Secret of NIMH. So you were working with a whole bunch of Disney folks.
Disney folks that I didn't know. And they were just, and now, as I hear from Gary Goldman all the time, we're just laughing about how wonderful things were back then.
Sure. And then you finished The Secret of NIMH. And how did you get to Disney? How did that all come about?
Okay, here we go. It's another funny story. The first time I heard that Disney was looking for workers, follow-up artists, was on Little Mermaid. And because, it was crunch time. Crunch time is busy, busy. So I drove to Glendale looking for it, and I couldn't find it. And at that time, I was with a girlfriend. I wasn't crazy about being with anyway, and I didn't want to start making a lot of money, but that's digressing. I'm sorry.
It's life.
But I didn't work on Little Mermaid because I couldn't find it. So a year later, the crunch time for Rescuers Down Under was happening. And I said, what? I got to go for it this time. I was always terrified of the rejection, because when I was 8 years old, Daddy used to watch me draw at the Wonderful World of Disney watching cartoons. And he said, maybe one day you work for Disney, buddy. And I said, no, Dad. It's in California. We're in Kansas City. That's not going to happen. So those moments caught up with me. It was really hard. It was heavy. I was nervous. Vera was there. So I knew I had a foot in, because I did pretty good at Don Bluth's studio for that. So I had grown and I was ready. And they picked me up and the roller coaster started the day I started. February 1st, 1990.
Wow.
The roller coaster started. I started as a breakdown artist.
Yeah, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about those positions for our listeners. If you could, because I know you were a cleanup supervisor, but most people outside the industry don't know what that is. But if you could talk a little bit about what a breakdown artist is, and then what a cleanup lead and a cleanup supervisor. So have at it.
Let's go all the way down. And I'll do it. The best way to do it is to start with my own career. And we can see how that, because my own Disney career. Now we can see how it goes. I started as a breakdown artist, which means we are doing in-betweens of all the animation that's been done. You're down to nothing but in-betweens in between that wonderful animation that's been done. They have in-betweeners. They have breakdown artists. The breakdown artist we'll do the, say, for instance, you have five drawings. Keith's done the first and the last. The breakdown, the assistant's going to do the center. The breakdown and the in-betweeners will do those three and two drawings, number three and two drawings. So the line has already been established. The look has already been established. All you have to do is follow the line and put it exactly where it's supposed to be based on the charts that we read that the animators has established, because that's how you get the timing working. So I was doing in-betweens on Rescuers Down Under. Ants Forever. Remember, we had scenes with all those ants. And you remember that? Yeah. That was my start. And then once again, there was Renee, who would also was also I knew. And she says, I'm working on this beautiful little lizard, you know, in Rescuers Down Under.
Frank the lizard.
Yeah. She says, why don't you come work on the lizard with me? Because she knew me already. And bam. So that put me in a unit with a character. So I was in absolute heaven at that time. I'm, you know, I was really doing good. Then here comes order that went.
All right, we missed that. We missed that because they
moved me up to assistant animator.
We missed what you just said because you froze for a moment.
We froze. Oh, okay. Yeah. I moved up to assistant animator after the end of Rescuers. So after I moved, I was doing assistant animation, which if you go back to those five drawings, I'm doing that middle drawing every time now. I'm working heavy. My father had passed away in between. And so I was just devastated because, you know, this whole business, as far as I was concerned, was because daddy in his own way pushed me, you know, towards.
But he knew before he passed that you were working at Disney.
Yeah, and I signed my contract. And so, boy, did he go to the barbershop and brag when I signed that contract.
I would have too. Yeah.
Ooh, man. No, he went. Well, my boy just signed. He was just in heaven.
I love that. I love it.
I was happier for him than I was for me at that time. Anyway, I moved up to assistant animator, and I was working pretty good, but I was devastated with daddy being gone. So we were working heavy overtime on Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. So I dived into the overtime, but during my overtime hours, I would always go work on the Beast unit with Bill Berg and Glenn Keane and follow up that, because he's really hard to follow up. There is no such creature as the Beast. So we had to kind of feel our way through it. So he wanted people they believed in. So Glenn got to know me at that time and fell in love with me and then started picking out scenes. He said, Marshall, here, I want you to do this. I want you to do this. Wow. Okay. So all of a sudden,
by the way, I have to say, like, you and Bill Berg were the unsung heroes on the Beast, because if you saw Glenn's rough animation, boy, it is rough. And you guys had to go in there and pick the actual line, you know, that needed to be laid down for the final drawings.
Our favorite thing was, it's like looking at a Michelangelo drawing, looking at Glenn's work, but there are lines all over the place. Somewhere in there, the Beast is in there. This beautiful Beast drawing is in there somewhere. So we have to look for that every day, all the time.
You know what they say? They say, you know, once you give a glance at how the sausage is made, it's not pretty. But by the end of after you touch it, it is pretty.
That's right. I never want to know how they make sausage.
That's right.
So that was us. We were just it just worked, and I was working so much, and I gained like 20 pounds because I was eating. And Dave, you were there. You remember that?
I still have that extra poundage. You know, because when you're working all of this overtime, they're feeding you. They're catering.
Really good food.
They're catering the dinners in from all these different restaurants.
Hold the phone for a minute. Hold the phone, because I see you guys animating in the trailers and doing all these things. And I see you guys like maybe at the snack room, the break room, and like getting a bunch of vending machine. No, you have catering here?
It was serious catering.
It was serious.
It was like the best restaurants in town.
Are you kidding
Absolutely. Every night. Eating and drawing all the time.
That's amazing.
So by the time Beauty and the Beast had finished, Bill and Glenn had moved me up to Key and kept me on for the Aladdin unit when we went to Aladdin. And there I was working on Aladdin again. Now, I'm in Aladdin, by the way.
Oh, is there a caricature of you in
there? Yeah, I'm a caricature in Aladdin. I'm one of the vendors chasing Aladdin around.
I thought that was you. I have to tell you, I love the fact that throughout those Disney films that we all worked on, there are little caricatures of different artists and you know, sometimes the directors, because Ron and John are caricatured as
we put them in all the time. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, in crowd scenes and that's things right. like that in yeah. Aladdin.
Kirk and Gary, we did that with them too. Yeah, we love it. Yeah, that's what they do. That's what they're for.
That's right.
Yeah,
we did that. So, and I was happy to be in it, and it was just great. But I kept zooming up this ladder, and I was in the right place at the right time, and I gotta say this, I gotta back up a little bit, Dave, because Disney took me because I was an artist. They didn't take me because I was Black. And I really, really...
I was just about to say that. I go, it has nothing to do with anything other than your talent.
Absolutely. And that's what I loved about these guys.
Yeah, that was it. It was only about talent. They didn't care about anything else. It was your talent, what you brought to the project and what went up on the screen. That's all that mattered.
That's right.
And that I love that about it. So Aladdin was going great. And once again, at 9 o'clock at night, while I'm sitting there at my desk drawing, during the Rodney King ride,
I remember
it was one of that night, because I remember Emily crying, one of the artists. She was Emily Juliana yeah. crying, and I'm trying to calm her down, and because she had to go home. And I'm like, okay. And it was 9 o'clock.
That was when security came around and told us to leave. Right.
Yeah,
because the riots were breaking out they were coming over the hill and they closed the whole facility down. Right.
That's absolutely right. Now, that day, while I'm working, I got a phone call from Don Hahn, who was in London at the time. Mm-hmm. He said, Marshall, we want to offer you your own character on Lion King. And, you know, after I picked the phone back up, I'm like, okay, Don, please don't play with me. It's too late. I love you. You're great. But don't tease me like that, because you're stepping on my pinky toe when you tease me like that. But not only that, he says, we're going to give you a chance. Wanted to do the hyenas, because that's what he had offered me.
Right.
And at that moment, I didn't care. I'm like, you just offered me my own character? I'll do whatever. And he had to say, I can't give you the hyenas. And I said, okay. He says, but I can give you, I have a small, two small characters, and it's not going to be the same, but I'm going to give you this character named Rafiki, and I'm going to give you the vultures, who were cut from the movie, of course, but I'm going to give you this character named Rafiki. Don't know what he looks like. We haven't figured out anything. Oh, my goodness. There you go. My world changed once again, completely. Yeah. It blew up. I had my own character at Disney. I wish Daddy would have been around for that.
Let me ask you this, though. Can you explain to the audience, to our listeners, what a character cleanup lead, and like you got your own character. What does that mean? You're working directly with the animator, right?
Yes. The directing animator, who James Baxter, who was the supervisor for Rafiki, I'm directly under him. I'm doing the drawings, animator's rough animation that will be seen on the screen.
Yeah.
Every drawing I'm doing is seen on the screen, and that's cleanup animation, period. You are cleaning up, as we laugh about cleaning up the Glenn Keane drawings and all, you still have to keep the perfect animation in there. You can't lose Glenn Keane's animation by trying to make a print. You have to keep his world and bring it to the screen and not have an ego as you're doing it, because they are your drawings. But you ego has to be out the door at Disney.
I think that's true in animation, because it's such a team effort. I mean, you know it as well as I do. There's 300-500 artists that are working on these movies.
Absolutely. But to be a supervisor of these characters, it changed my whole life. It changed my whole career. So Rafiki was my, and we went through two animators before we got to James, I think.
Was it just because it was a difficult character to try and nail down?
Yes, or it was because we couldn't figure out. I mean, if you look at that type of animal, it's beautiful with the colors and everything, but everything else is kind of scary. It's pretty vicious, you know? Yeah. And so we have to figure out how to turn that into a pleasing Disney character that the kids will wear and carry on their lunch pails, you know? Yeah, so we have to try to make it as pleasing as possible. So that's when the creative process is great, because I get to sit with the directors and James and everybody else, and we all come up with what the look is for Rafiki. And man,
which to me, it gets back to the fact that this is a team effort, and you do have to leave your egos at the door. You know, you've got all of these great artists together, but you're working as a team, you know, to create that end product that's going to go up onto the movie screen that the audiences are going to see.
I have a question, Marshall. Did you know that Robert Guillaume was going to be the voice of Rafiki beforehand?
Not until he was. We didn't know. We knew he had been cast, but I didn't know who they chose.
What was your reaction when you found out?
My first reaction was, why would they hire Benson for this? That's my first reaction. Right. I was confused. But he was fine. He came out great. And he and I laughed about it later on. He passed away last year.
Yeah.
But we had a good laugh about it because he kept calling me, he didn't call me Marshall, he kept calling me Michael, and I was getting on my nerves. But we finally got there. It was okay.
That's awesome.
I appreciate Don Hahn, who is my favorite producer. Not that anybody else wasn't a great producer, but I did three movies with Don. He liked the orchestra while they recorded, or in front of Robert while he was recording. Or I got to give it to Don. He knew how to get the best out of you.
Right. And he was also very even keeled.
Yes.
You know, and I think that was always a real plus in how he worked with the artists.
Yeah.
He was kind of unflappable.
He is unflappable. When we were doing Atlantis, and we're in Ireland at a dinner, and we're sitting there talking. It was a press conference that Kirk didn't want to go to. And he said, Marshall, you go. I don't want to go. I'm like, okay, So it was great. I loved it. Everybody, it was private planes and the whole thing. I loved that kind of stuff. That's my world right there. Anyway, at the dinner, Don said, you're going to have an interview tomorrow with about 90 different things, and you're going to have 90 different interviewers, and you're going to have to draw Milo every time. I said, Don, I have never drawn Milo. I oversaw all the characters, but I made sure people that could draw Milo would draw him, and I wouldn't have to draw him. So at that dinner, on a napkin, Don showed me how to draw Milo. That's how good an artist he was.
Oh, he's a terrific artist.
He's a terrific artist. He showed me how to draw Milo. And then that next day, I had to do 92 interviews and draw Milo 92 times.
Wow. That's just unbelievable. You know, you were talking about, being a cleanup supervisor. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you, as a cleanup supervisor, you're not necessarily drawing every single character to perfection. You're actually managing all of the artists, right?
I'm managing all the artists. The great thing about being a supervisor is I get to make sure that the character has the line that I want. And that's what I love about Tarzan, the movie Tarzan. It was hard. It put me in the hospital, but the line, that was my line.
How did it put you in the hospital working on Tarzan?
Here we go.
Well, let's hear that story.
Tarzan's the hardest movie I ever worked on. That's number one. And plus, it was the first time I had ever been a supervisor. And when I say supervisor, remember we had three or 200 something people in cleanup animation?
Yeah.
And some were in Paris, some were in Florida. The majority were in were in LA, in Burbank. Mm-hmm. And they were mine. They were all mine. and so I'm wrangling, who's going to draw this? Who's going to draw that?
There's a lot of stress. A lot of stress.
Yeah, but who's going to be in this team? But, you know, so not only that, it's my first time, so everything's intimidating me. Everything's like, okay, this is weird. Are they mad at me for that? Yeah, who cares? But I didn't know that at the time, you know? Also, I didn't have a fix-it crew, which is I made that mistake, and I was doing all the fixes. And Leslie Bentivegna, she was my production editor. All she would ever do is bring in stacks of scenes and say, fix it, here, fix it, fix it. And I'm fixing everything. And I had to fire a guy. I had to go to all these meetings. I hadn't thought about all of that. I hadn't thought it all the way through of being a suit. But all of that, it just caught up with me. And I wanted it to be beautiful.
Well,
it's
sure.
my first movie.
Of course. And it was.
I wanted it to be the best thing we had ever done. And so all of that pressure I was putting on myself. Nobody did this to me but me.
Yeah.
At the end of almost 2 months left, I got double pneumonia because I wasn't sleeping. I was working. I wasn't sleeping. I was drinking. I was eating too much. It was just crazy. I just overdid it. I completely overdid it. And
so you had double pneumonia, and that put you in the hospital. How long were you in the hospital for? Like a week?
No, I was in there for like 2 months. Really? I was here for 2 months of a movie. Yeah, I didn't come out. I didn't sit and finish the last scene of the movie or anything. I was in the hospital, but I was at the wrap party.
Wow.
Yeah, it just was crazy. And it was, I had to, Michael saw me and I forgot, one of our other producers was standing there. And I was talking to Michael Eisner and I said, I'm tired. I just got out of the hospital and this movie put me in the hospital. And I was laughing about it. And Michael looks at that, my producer, and I can't remember. I think it was, I don't remember. Anyway, he says, well, why was Marshall in the hospital? And then I see, I did 249,000 drawings, and, you know, it was. But it just kind of did. But, yeah, we ended up doing 249,000 drawings.
Yeah, and you know something, I think that, you know, we all had gotten ourselves into those situations where you work yourself to the bone, really, and you get sick, and after that happens, you get into the mode of taking care of yourself.
Until I got too bad, and Tarzan took me out.
Yeah.
So when Atlantis came, and Kirk and Gary says, come on, do Atlantis with us. And I'm like, I gotta do that with you guys. I love you guys. So Leslie decided to stay with me as production manager. I said, we're gonna do this one right, and we're not gonna make any stressful mistakes. And Atlantis was the most fun I've ever had making a movie ever. Mm. It was smooth. It worked out fun.
You know, we had Kirk Wise on last week, and we talked briefly about Atlantis, because I think it's a very underrated movie. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, it has built up. It was underrated when it first came out, but it has built up a big fan base.
They have it's a little cult base. They love it. And we're all involved. We say hi and give our little interviews on that, because they just, that Atlantis crowd, they want to learn the language. It gets a little scary. Yeah.
Well, and you know, this year is the 20th anniversary. This year is the 20th anniversary of Atlantis, the Lost Empire, which is pretty amazing.
That is going to be, I can't believe it's 20 years. Wow.
It's great. It's a great film. Wow.
Yeah.
It's total craziness.
Wow. Well, it's been that my Disney years were incredible. I mean, I kept moving, rising, you know? Yeah. And man.
Now, when did you leave? When did you leave?
I left.
Were you part of that whole, it was really the transition from 2D to CG, and when they did the big layoff at the studio? What year was that?
Wow, that's the year. I can only go by the year based on the movies. That was Home on the Range year, whatever, because that was the last thing we did.
What was that? 2004. 2004. Yeah, Home on the Range. Brother Bear, Home on the Range, 2004. And then you came back for Princess and the Frog in 2009. Yeah,
we
came back for
that. But we had left completely.
Yeah.
After Home on the Range, I had to lay off 92 people in succession all the way through the movie. I had to figure out the time. And I kept trying to explain to the folks, because they're mad at me because you just don't want me here, I'm out of here at the end. Now, here's what I did. When we stopped that movie, that whole thing, we were done. I had Marge Randolph, who was our HR person. I said, Marge, give me a call across the street with somebody. She says, what are you talking about? I said, I told her my idea. She got me a call with the lady that produces the Hunger Games movies.
Yeah, okay.
And I can't think of her name right now because I would say it because she's wonderful and she's on my good list forever. I went to her office and she's like, got this, what do you want and who are you? and I told her who I was. I told her where I've been for 20 years and that we're done. They're transitioning. Yeah. And I said, I understand that we have to leave, but there are 40,000 working people here. Most of us are artists that have been trained all over these years through Disney. Why would you let us go? She says, well, I think you might be right. She says, let me see what I can do. She got me an assistant art director job on a movie called Sky High with Kurt Russell.
Love it.
Uh-huh. So, yeah.
That was great. It was a great let go of the animation world for a second, because it broke my heart that we all had to leave. So
was that Robin Bissell, who was the exec producer on Hunger Games?
No, it's a lady and
Susan Collins.
Mm-mm.
I know.
You're getting close.
Anyway.
Start with an A. What's her name?
One of the co-producers, is it Aldrich? Yes. Aldrich Porter?
No, it's a lady.
Alvarez. Alvarez. Diana Alvarez.
No.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just shooting in the dark here with all the A's here.
I like
you
all day, and I'm like, nope.
But that gig that you got, certainly you realize there's life after Disney. Of course there's life after Disney.
That was important because, man, I didn't think, you put 20 years into something, you don't think there's really a lot out there for you. Or what do I do now? I forgot that I could draw and paint and everything. I'm like, what do I do now?
Yeah.
And there that was. So,
Sky High. Yeah, and Sky High was kind of like, pre-Marvel. So this was like the whole, like, we're going to try to do this Disney, fun superhero type of franchise. And if it wasn't for them buying Marvel a couple of years later, who knows where that could have gone.
Yeah, it could have turned into absolutely. Yeah. And it was a great little movie. I enjoyed it. I designed a lot of stuff on it, including a few sets, which are like just tunnels. They didn't want me doing any big stuff, but I was having a good time.
Hey, it's a fun film.
Great.
Yeah, but again, it's life after Disney, and that is a thing, because I think our listeners should know this, that when you have a run at the Disney Animation Studio where you could go for decades. I mean, we worked with people who were there for 40 and 50 years. Joe Grant and Bernie Mattinson and
Bernie
like that. Yeah. But. If somebody was there for 20 or 25 years or 30 years and then they left or got pushed out into the street, some of them didn't handle it well. You know that.
Oh, man. No. Ooh, I know a few I'm not even going to get into some of those tragic stories, but that's how much we put into it.
Yeah, but the fact is that there was and is life after Disney Animation. There's actually more opportunities for those skill sets today than there's ever has been, I think.
That's absolutely right. And I was worried that we would fall by the wayside. And I'm like, how could you let this American art form fall to the wayside? But we didn't. And later, they kind of called us all for Princess, because we wanted to do the Beatles thing, get back together and make one great piece and then walk away. Nobody felt good about Home on the Range. We just did not. And I haven't watched it
since
we made it.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no idea. So I even the grandkids, I should try to get them to watch it. Just, but I'm worried. Yeah,
you know what? Nobody's rushing out to have an anniversary screening of the movie, right?
I'll be there by myself, Tim.
Oh, my. Now I have to see it again, you know, so I just have to revisit it again just to, because I remember going to Florida and seeing the team work on Home on the Range when I would go through the studio tour. And, you know, that's just, it's one of those things you just kind of have to revisit, you know.
Well, someday.
But you know, a lot of these films, though, you know, you kind of, you know, leave them behind. But over time, you know, you have to get some distance on some of these pictures.
Yes,
you really do.
You really have to.
Yeah. I mean, there's been so many pictures over the years that have gone out and didn't do as well as they thought. But then they had legs. They really sort of picked up. I mean, look at Nightmare Before Christmas. That didn't do very well when it first opened. Now it's, it's a juggernaut. I mean, with merchandise and annual screenings and all of that kind of stuff, you know?
Absolutely. So,
which is amazing. But, you know, you finished Princess and the Frog, and then what did you do?
After that, life kind of punched me in the gut, but that's okay. That happens to everybody. I got a phone call from a guy, because I just kind of stepped away for 2 years and started working on my fine art, which I'm glad I did because it got me back into my fine art. But then I got a call from a producer that was doing some test animation, like, let's do a Curious George test for this, see if we can get this job. I said, yeah, I'll come over and do that. Well, I went over and started doing that, but they showed me how to draw on the Cintiq.
Ah, yes.
And that's where the Cintiq came in, and Harmony and all of that. So I started learning that while I'm doing all these little tests.
Yeah.
And it really, really helped. And then comes now, and right now I'm working on finishing up Space Jam 2. But on Cintiq, because the whole thing is on Cintiq. So.
Everything's gone that way. But, you know, I think we know enough artists that have evolved with the technology over the years.
Yeah.
But some haven't. Some decided that I don't want to do that, and they've left the industry. But a lot of people have. A lot of us have evolved and grabbed onto the technology.
Yeah, and I was one that fought it. I mean, when we were at Disney, I'm like, you know what? No, man, I was taught to do this from the masters, you know,
right. On paper.
And my mind is there.
Pencil and paper, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
It got me for a minute, but now that I'm working, I've done a whole movie on Harmony. It's not bad. I'm
yeah. Okay. You got a handle on it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I want to talk a little bit about your fine art too, because you've really, correct me if I'm wrong, because I think this is probably true of a lot of artists.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're working those 60, 70, 80 hour weeks to try and get a picture finished, your personal work kind of falls to the wayside, doesn't it?
Yes. Who has time? Or you don't feel like looking at it, you know?
You're creatively spent.
Yes.
You know, by the time you get home, you know, after a 10 or 12 hour day, and the last thing you want to do is to pick up a pencil and draw again, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, I've got this fine art kind of thing moving, and I don't want to stop the train.
Right.
I've got a portrait of Abraham Lincoln that's in the museum in Illinois, in the Abraham Lincoln Museum in Illinois.
And by the way, I actually saw you did a beautiful illustration of Frederick Douglass that you had posted on social media, and I was blown away. And I was like, Marshall Toomey, I go, that's what you've been up to, you know?
Thank you, I appreciate that. That means a lot. You know, one of the things, think about how talented every artist was at that company.
And is
to this day at that company. So I had to sit by myself for a moment, so to speak, and just kind of get back into my, can you see? Are you looking?
Yeah. That's, I can see. Yeah.
One of my pieces right there. I'm just finishing that up right now.
Awesome.
It's taken up, but it helps me now. I can work and then I can just turn around and just paint because this will relax me now.
Yeah.
It took me a second to get there, but yeah. Now I'm there.
So. No, and you know something, I think that was true with a lot of artists, is that a lot of times their personal work sort of took a back seat for you know, sometimes for years before they got that sort of balance back, where wow. there was a pleasurable aspect of just doing your own artwork. And I know for me personally, that happened. And there was a good 10, 12 year gap of doing, you know, and it really, I kind of point to the 90s. I blame the 90s.
Me too.
I blame the 90s for fashion and for not doing my own art because we did pictures like Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King, Pocahontas, Tarzan. I mean, there were so many pictures packed into that decade that we did, and we were going from one picture to the next, and we were like, we were on overtime. Time almost continuously.
Continuous overtime. I like that. Yeah, it was overtime. You know?
So to me, you know, I as I moved up the ladder, I felt like I started to get back a little bit of that free time to do my own art, you know?
Yeah. That's good because you can lose it. I lost it. And I didn't have time to get back into it. And I'm like, I have to make the time. I got to figure out the balance. It took me a while to figure that life balance and a couple of marriages and everything to get that life balance and everything figured out. You know, it really does.
Absolutely, without question. So what are you doing now with your fine art? Because you do have gallery representation, right?
I had from London. They haven't done a lot for me. I'm a little annoyed. I had signed with this London group and I was very happy about them. I haven't heard, but right now I have a piece that's in a show in Laguna. It's an online show. Uh-huh. And
everybody's adapting with this pandemic, right?
I have finished a couple of really nice masterpieces, master art portraits of Kennedy and George Washington that I'm on my way to City Hall with just to see if I can get them up there. So
nice.
Yeah. So this stuff is fun, man. It's just, it's just me and my art, you know?
Yeah.
It's not 240 cleanup artists behind me.
Yeah. No. And you don't have that pressure.
Yeah.
You know, because that to me is, it adds to the stress and it wears you down.
Yeah.
You know, it really does. You know, when you think about your career, what do you look back on and what do you point to and say, wow, that was an unbelievable experience?
Secret and M was a life changing experience because I didn't know I could do that type of animation. At that time, I really, heavy metal pretty much changed it because I realized I can work on movies. That's what heavy metal taught me. The heavy metal movie taught me. So that was, Rafiki changed my entire life. Bonus check, character, interviews, articles in Black Enterprise magazine and all these. I was everywhere after Rafiki.
Yeah.
That's a big one for me. That's a very, very, very big one for me. Tarzan, it, despite everything I went through on it, it was a great moment for my career. It took that next step for me.
Still love the soundtrack to that movie.
Isn't it?
With amazing Phil Collins.
Phil used to walk around in the studio in jeans and t-shirts. So nobody, he'd come sit in my office and eat all my Girl Scout cookies, talk on the phone to my wife and walk out. It was very relaxed.
He was hilarious because I remember walking down the hall one day and I heard some talking behind me and I looked and then I did a double take because I was like, damn, that's Phil Collins.
Just wandering around. And because he's dressed so, you know, t-shirt and jeans like the rest of us in the, our uniforms, he blended right in. It was just great.
Truth be told, that's the musician's outfit. You know, I mean, you know, I'm a musician myself, so I laugh about that. By the way, fun fact, Phil Collins and the Tarzan soundtrack, one of maybe three records in pop culture that went to number one for Disney. Went to number one. Yeah, absolutely. Right? In the Billboard charts. Yeah, D23. Wow. Yeah, D23 just posted about it not too long ago. And I was like, that's pretty awesome. Because there's, I mean, we all think about the soundtrack for Beauty and the Beast and the Peebo Bryson, Celine Dion and everything. No, didn't hit number one. Phil Collins and Tarzan hit number one on Billboard. So, but once again, that's just great. And also, I blame
feather in our caps.
Yeah. And also, I blame the 90s for the lack of electric guitar solos, since I am a guitar player. So yes, I blame the 90s as well. But yeah, it's good stuff though. I mean, we have so many, once again, just so many great films under your belt, and man, I'm a fan of all of them. I know that our listeners are certainly fans to all of them, and I know we've got a couple questions to talk about. So I'll let you guys kind of continue to do things.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Marshall, just about the fact that you didn't go to art school, did you?
I went to college.
Did you take art?
You know, study art.
What was your major in college?
Art history.
Art history. Okay. Well, so you're art history. All right. You know, I buy into that, you know, but you're basically self-taught.
Yes, absolutely. Completely. You know, I would say I learned here and there, but everything else is self-taught.
Yeah. And you know, the interesting thing about that is we had one other guest on, you know him very well, Mike Gabriel. He's another one who never went to art school. He was self-taught, you know, and I find that fascinating. I really do. I think that's really amazing that you have to be proud of that.
I am. And what I'm proud of is the passion that I had to keep following it. I didn't care about the lack of education, if I could figure out how they did it, you know.
Well, I'm still marveling at the fact that you left the Kansas City barbecue behind. You know,
that's hard.
Out to Los Angeles.
I ordered out here online and get to sit out there.
I was gonna say that's hard, man. I used to go to Kansas City all the time, man. The food was outstanding.
Yeah, don't play, man. We don't mess around. No. That was the hardest thing I had to do leaving Kansas City was leaving barbecue. So yeah. I order it now and get my sauce out here.
That's amazing. And I think I think people that are transplants from different parts of the country, there's those certain things that you kind of crave and look forward to and try and figure out, where can I find that? You know,
I gotta have something that tastes like home. I mean, I appreciate being in California and all of that, but I gotta have something that tastes like Kansas City.
Did you ever think about moving back to Kansas City? Or are you just too entrenched out in L.A. now?
You know, my blood is thinned out. I get cold really fast.
Of course.
I'm with you, my friend. I'm with you, you know. I can't do the New York winters anymore.
I was going to say, Dave.
My brother's like, come home in January. I will not come home in January.
Yeah, right.
Let me ask you, what advice would you give to a young artist who's just starting out? I mean, somebody who maybe is listening to this show, they're in high school and they're thinking they want to go into animation. What would you say to them?
I would say passion. Bottom line to the whole thing. It, people say, oh, you're so talented and you're so this. And you know what the talent is the urge to get up every morning and do it and to jump into it all day and give it everything you got. That's the talent. That's the key, is passion. You have to passionate art.
You got to love it, right? You got to love
it. You got to love it. You can't just like this business. You got to love this business, because it's going to beat you up like Mike Tyson.
you can't just say, I want to be a Disney artist. You know, you can't just say it. You have to actually work hard at trying to get there.
And one of the things, I was one of the cats that would look at the portfolios. yeah. all the time and, yeah. and study quote. I did not want to see Disney characters in there. My portfolio, my one Ralph Bakshi, I had everything in there since I was 2 years old, I think, in that portfolio. But he laughed about that. But my Disney portfolio was nothing but fine art, illustration, construction, stuff, drawings like that, you know, not but, paintings, but the paintings.
They wanted to see that you could draw, that you were a draftsman, that you were an Absolutely. Artist. They wanted to see the construction of your drawings. That's why they always asked for life drawings. They wanted to see that you could draw.
Absolutely. I don't care if you can draw He-Man and Fat Albert. I don't care about that. I don't right. want to see that. And that was, and I had to say that a few times to a few folks that sent in portfolios. I'm like, don't. Give us stuff with our own characters, and we know what our characters look like. Don't try to tell us how to draw them. Don't show us you can draw them better. We want to see that you can draw, period. And if you can draw, period, we got you.
Yeah. So, Al John, do we have some questions to ask?
You got it.
Skull Rock Podcast answers your email.
All righty, Jeffy D is asking the question here to you. We want to know, outside of your character, all right, the outside of doing Rafiki, do you have a favorite Filmation and a favorite Disney character that you enjoy drawing?
Yes. Filmation, oh, wow. This is really silly. I usually was working on the villains. Drawing the villains on He-Man was fabulous to me because they were different every week, every time. We had a lot of stock footage of the main folks, so who cared? But that. The other thing I really enjoyed drawing was Quasimodo.
Really?
There you go.
Yes, man. And, you know, that little ugly guy.
Right.
As ugly as he was, we tried to make him cute.
Yeah.
And it...
Well, there's a humanity there you put in.
Well, I'm sure he was yeah. cute to his mother.
No, it's just
yeah, yeah.
But the idea of making him pleasing in a Disney character, that was the greatest challenge that was a wonderful challenge. I mean, the Beast was one thing, but making this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we knew what he looked like already. You know, it was, I enjoyed that. So that was a challenge, and I did good on it. I accept yeah. that one.
No, that's great.
Awesome.
Derek asked a question here. So we love the Disney parks here, and obviously you're very close in proximity to Disneyland. Do you have a particular attraction that you like over there at Disneyland?
Not anymore. I was a big Pirates maniac, but then after the movie came out, I just didn't need to go see it yeah. I bet whoever asked that question is disappointed now.
No. Hey, look, that's great. That's great. Well, and then, of course, my wife, Kristen, being the Disney foodie, wants to know, do you have a particular favorite snack or Disney food that you liked? If you were going to the parks or the hotel or anything, is there a particular place or restaurant even that you appreciate? Yeah.
So have you ever had any of the candy apples?
Oh, absolutely.
No, I get one every time I go to Disneyland. And candy apples. I love those big, giant, messy, nasty.
No, that's great. Last question, Alda is asking, how do you feel about Princess and the Frog being kind of like the love letter to hand-drawn animation for Disney fans?
That's exactly what it was. I'm so happy to hear somebody said that, because for us, it was, we had to come back and do it one more time. Just to show that how we do it. This is how we do this, okay? The other stuff we did, the later, it just wasn't. But we wanted to do one special. And then we can walk away. I think we, you know, it's the Beatles, Abbey Road. That's what we did. We did Abbey Road for ourselves. And then we walked away. And I'm happy yeah. with that.
I love the film. I think Princess and the Frog is just so great. On so many different levels, storytelling, animation, characters, just everything. It just harkens back to what is at the heart of what makes a Disney film. And so the fans love Princess and the Frog, and we're so happy to have you talk about it.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the best. And that's the way to go out, as far as I was concerned. That's the
You say the way to go out, but do you think, and we're going to phrase this in a way that, I mean, do you feel as though they could do a movie like Princess and the Frog today? Do you think the talent is there? Do you think they would know how to do a movie like that again?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. You know, I gotta
say, the talent is still there. Yeah,
talent's right there. Yeah.
You
know, the bottom line, anything we have ever done has been story.
Yeah.
So you know, you get the right story cats working, and we're good. We're good to go. But it's got to be story.
Yeah.
I remember our first visual of Beauty and the Beast, and everybody was in the theater. I was sitting behind Roy and.
Roy Disney.
Roy Disney was, Michael was there, and somebody, Jeffrey
Katzenberg, probably.
And he was so annoyed. Jeffrey was so annoyed at our first screen. He said, well, we reached the new low. And he got up and walked out. And I'm like, wow, what just happened? Oh my God. But he did that all the time. It's what I came to realize. But, sure. I didn't know that but man, and then we turned it into a movie. We wrote it and rewrote and rewrote and rewrote, as we always do in animation. And it comes out great.
And that's always the way, you know. It's build it up, tear it down, build it up, tear it down. Yeah. And every time you build it back up, it's that much better.
Yeah, it gets better and better. And then finally, it's wonderful. So Beauty and the Beast was my first education in everything of how to do a Disney movie. Yeah. Rescuers, I was finishing up, so I didn't get to be involved in the whole process, but watching that whole thing, man, it's great.
Yeah. Well, a lot of great pictures. Well, I think we're at the end of our time.
Marshall, it was a blast.
Marshall Toomey, it was so great having you on the Skull Rock podcast. And we have more to talk about at a future date, I'm sure.
Like Space Jam. Like Space Jam. We got to talk about Space Jam at some point.
We're going to have to talk about Space Jam when it comes. Space Jam 2.
Yeah, because I'll say stuff. You guys know me. I'll say whatever I feel like saying.
Spoilers.
No. Let's wait until Space Jam 2 comes out. How's that?
I'll come back and do that. Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, because one thing our listeners cannot see is the fact that he's got the Warner Brothers animation tribute to Mel Blanc right behind him. I can see it.
Oh, yeah, dude. Yeah,
I see it. I was looking at that. It's right like, there. I know that piece of art because I know that piece of art. I know that's the Mel Blanc tribute. And so, yes. We're going to have you and Tony Bancroft come back because I know he's working on Space Jam 2 as well. Can't
wait. All righty. All right, Marshall, thank you so much. Thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
So much.
It was great seeing you. You look fantastic. And I look forward to seeing you in person at some point.
Anytime. We'll do that
after this pandemic is over.
There you go. You know? I can't wait. Maybe for the Atlantis thing. Come to that, man.
There we go.
Where are we?
All right. You guys. Thank you.
Thank you. You're the best. Appreciate it.
Your attention, please. Now loading on track number one. For a trip around Walt Disney's Magic Kingdom.
Skull Rock Podcast.
All aboard.
Your main street to the world of Disney.
Well, that was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
Marshall Toomey is fantastic. He's such a great artist. I'd really encourage some people that are listening, if you're interested, just Google Marshall Toomey and take a look at some of his artwork that's online. Yeah. It's fabulous. He's a great artist, good friend. Somebody who's been in the business and knows his stuff, you know?
Well, there's once again, you know, much like the music that provides the soundtrack for our childhood, all these guests, you know, like Marshall is probably part of the tapestry that makes us who we are, what we love. Starting with heavy metal, just going all the way back to that and the Filmation, you know, stuff that he was involved in all the way through the Disney era. Just once again, just great stuff. So it was great having him on the show.
It was. And, you know, we've got some great guests coming up, Al John. Next week, we've got Max Howard.
Oh,
now,
wow.
This is going to be a great interview. Max is going to be at our Green Room studio facility in London.
What?
Yes, he's going to be in London, and he's going to be on with us here with you in Nashville and me in Los Angeles.
Oh, my goodness.
Max was a studio chief. He's a producer. I mean, holy mackerel. I mean, my friendship with Max Howard goes back to the Who Framed Roger Rabbit days.
I can't believe when you mentioned that you got Max to come onto this program, I just about fell out of my chair. So,
it's going to be really terrific. And we've got some great talents booked in the coming weeks. So I'm hoping people come back and visit us.
Well, speaking of great people coming back, we do want to say our shout out to some of our great supporters on the program. Once again, if you want to donate to the show because it's made possible by people like you, our listeners, feel free to check out anchor.fm/Skull Rock Podcast to support the show every month. We would like to give our thanks to Lindsay, Charles, Spencer, and Joshua. Thank you so much for that. And once again, check out our link there on Anchor if you want to donate to the show. And once again, Dave, I want to encourage our listeners to keep on emailing us or posting on social media, DMing us with any question whatsoever, regardless of whether it's for one of our upcoming guests or our guests on the show or Dave or myself about Disney and pop culture, films, and animation. Feel free to email us, aljohn@skullrockpodcast.com or dave@skullrockpodcast.com.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, Aljohn, when we get questions from our listeners, we are asking our guests those questions.
Yeah.
So just realize that.
And they're delighted to answer those. I mean, just look at what happened here. I mean, this is just great when you have Marshall answering those questions. And once again, also big thanks once again to Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com, Disney Dorks as well for allowing us to continue to post and promote the show on all their platforms and on social media. So thank you for that as well. Dave, any final words?
Well, you know, as I always say, peace and love to everybody. Go out, have a fantastic week ahead, and be kind to one another. Have a great week, everybody, and we will see you next time here at Skull Rock Podcast.
I'm Aljohn Goh, co-host of the Disney List Podcast, as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock Podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they'd want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com. I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Aljohn Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List Podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.